we join Professor Warren Goldstein at the University of Hartford, where he discusses Martin Luther King Jr.'s time spent in Birmingham, Alabama, and the civil rights movement there in 1963. This is about an hour and a half.
Good afternoon, everybody. Nice to be here with you. As you can see, this is not the way we ordinarily do class. We don't always have a film crew from C-SPAN 3 here. We are lucky to have them here today. And because of the lights, it's going to be a little warm in here. And so Dave Isger has very kindly gotten us each a bottle of water. Thank you so much, Dave. And Caitlin, thank you all. All right. There you go, Maris. All right. So, as I said before, what we're going to do today is concentrate on the year 1963, but more specifically on the Birmingham struggle in the civil rights movement and in the life of Martin Luther King. And at the center of that is not only what happened in Birmingham itself, but the letter from Birmingham Jail, one of the most important documents, not only in modern African-American history, but also in modern American history as a statement of political and religious philosophy, but also as a statement of strategy and tactics. I love the letter. You know, I tried to write a book about it once. I still may get to do that. But the letter, to me, is something that every time I go at, I learn more from. Which is one of the reasons why I teach this course, as you know, because every time I get deeply into Martin Luther King, I find that I learn more from him. So you all have prepared. You now know about a lot. We've watched some of Eyes on the Prize. So you've seen some film of the civil rights struggle. You've read the chapter in Harvard Sitkoff's biography of King, Pilgrimage to the Mountaintop. So you've read a kind of more in-depth version of the civil rights struggle. Now it's time to have some conversation. So, why? Why is Birmingham? Why is the Birmingham struggle so important in the history of the civil rights movement? Tori.
Because, after the whole Albany thing, all the failures that happened, and then the Albany thing, and then the Birmingham was...
May I interrupt you for just 1 second? You said all the failures that happened, and then the Albany thing. So what do you mean by the failures that happened? We don't think of Martin Luther King as a failure, by and large, right? I mean, we study him because he was this great success. So what do you mean by that?
He had the cities that he went to had not been working out well for him. And so then when he went to Albany, that was, one of the worst failures that happened, because there were a lot of different reasons why it happened. They had too many, demands and...
Who's the they that you're referring to there?
The SCLC and then... SNCC.
The Southern Christian Leadership Conference, and what was the other organization that was involved there, Katie?
SNCC,
the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And so how would you describe what happened in Albany? Maris, take a stab at that. Tory's called it a failure.
It was a failure. They did not manage to cause any sort of conflict. The sheriff of that...
You mean the civil rights people, the civil rights marchers and activists were looking to cause a conflict...
Correct.
...but couldn't do it.
Yeah.
Why not?
Because they were just arrested. The police did not respond in a violent manner. They just arrested them and then released them the next day.
Anybody else on Albany? Yes, Heather?
The groups also didn't really work together. They were more just competing against each other.
They were competing against each other. Isn't that weird to think of civil rights groups that had exactly the same goal, right? In a really hostile environment, and here they are competing each other. Why on earth were they competing with each other? What do you think, Trey?
Just for attention to see who was the major group, and because they basically hated each other.
They hated each other? Isn't that a little strong? I don't know. What other people think about that? Najee?
I saw that there was a lot of tension between the two groups, and they both competed for the most attention.
They competed for attention. What was the... What's going on? Yeah, Davon.
I think the main reason why there was so much competition between the SCLC and SNCC was because they both had two different types of demands.
What do you mean by different types of demands?
SNCC wanted too many demands, and
they weren't really focused, right?
Didn't have a focused goal and a specific one specific thing that they wanted to get done. And they felt that the SDLC was being too lenient in their demands and was only going to compromise with what they were given. It wasn't going to go for a full.
So this is, you really said that beautifully. I mean, SNCC wanted to get rid of the whole structure of segregation in Albany, hadn't figured out how to do that exactly, but that's what they wanted to do, whereas SCLC, which is made up of older people by and large, right, generally men, ministers who wore suits and were much more kind of personally conservative in their worldview as opposed to these younger students, male and female, were not so formal, and they wanted to get rid of segregation all at once. And what did some of that tension ended up focusing on Martin Luther King himself, right? What was the problem with people in King? What was going on there, Nas?
He was like a sophomore slump.
Yeah. He was in kind of a sophomore slump after Montgomery. It had been going on for some time, right? We had talked about that. Here he has the success in Montgomery in what year? Starts in 55. When does it end? Oh. It ends in late 1956, and you know that. You know it, and you just got frozen by TV cameras being in the same room. But it wasn't just that. But the sophomore slump would have been 57. But nothing much happened in 57. And then 58, which could have been the junior slump. And 59, which could have been a senior slump. And still not much was going on with Martin Luther King and the SCLC. And the Freedom Ride. He missed the boat on the sit-ins at first. And what happened at the Freedom Ride in 61? He didn't go, right? And the young people wanted him to go, and he refused. And some people thought that he was a little full of himself, right? And a little too afraid for his own personal safety. And some of that stuff came about also in Albany in 1962, where King would fly in, and they would accuse him of then flying out. And the problem with being on the ground was that the cameras would leave when King left. And people in SNCC took to calling him. You remember what they took to calling him? The Lord, right? I mean, that's not just the Lord, right? It's meant to kind of stick a little knife in and twist it some, right? They thought he was too pompous, too prone to make a relationship between himself and Jesus, right? And so they called him the Lord, even though they respected him enormously, but they also knew that they were about something a little different. So Albany was fresh in everyone's mind, especially fresh in King's mind and the SCLC. So, huge amount of failure. We know it's more than a sophomore slump. It's gone on for a long time. No real successes for the movement. And then we come to Birmingham. Birmingham turns out to be really important. How did they approach Birmingham?
They were a lot more organized.
They were a lot more organized. What did they call it? What did Fred Shuttlesworth, the guy on the ground in Birmingham, call it? Project C, Lena, and that was C for what?
Confrontation.
C for confrontation. So what Maris said about what was not happening in Albany was designed specifically to happen in Birmingham, right? Now this is weird. Here we have the reputation of Martin Luther King, who's supposed to be the nonviolence guy, right? He's supposed to be the Christian love guy, the apostle of Christian love, who ended up being a martyr. And really talked about how you had to love your enemies all the time. So here he is specifically going after a civil rights tactic that is called Project C for confrontation. What does that do to how you think about King? What do you think about that, Sarai?
It kind of changes my perspective.
Did you have a different perspective on Martin Luther King before you got into this course and got into this section of it?
He didn't want to make any trouble.
You thought he didn't want to make trouble. Really?
But then as we went on in this course, I realized that he expected a war to kind of force President Kennedy to intervene.
He expected an uproar to force the President of the United States to intervene. That's an amazing thing, right? Here he is, an African-American preacher in the Deep South, in the United States, in the segregated South, in the early 1960s, and he is ambitious enough to think that he can get the President of the United States, the leader of the free world, right, to intervene on behalf of people that the president would never have met or known anything about. So I think a bunch of you may have thought that Martin Luther King was the kind of less interesting of the civil rights leaders, right? The one who wasn't so militant. Kareem, you had some thoughts about that.
Well, it's a very systematic and militant way of thinking, and we tend to think of it. We tend to think of it as Malcolm X, as the one of the most militant black leaders of that time. So, you know, viewing that with King's philosophy, it's kind of like contradicting itself. Like,
it changes the way you think about them, right? The standard way in which American culture thinks about Malcolm X and Martin Luther King, as you said very eloquently, is that the real militant is Malcolm X, right? The guy is the apostle of manliness. The guy is the apostle. I'm also a martyr, by the way.
By any means necessary.
Exactly. So that makes him seem the tough guy. Whereas King, and it's sort of odd because, you know, physically they're really different too, right? You know, Malcolm X, describe him physically.
Tall, masculine.
Thin too, right? Really thin. Whereas Martin Luther King? He's short and chubby, right? He's got very full cheeks. He's got appears to have soft skin. You know, he's shorter than most of the people around him. That was sort of a surprise, wasn't it? You think of him as a giant, right? But in fact, he was kind of short. He was shorter than I am. And I'm short. And they're so different that he looks like the soft guy and Malcolm X looks like the hard, tough guy. And Malcolm X had been a criminal. And he, you know, he'd been a thief. He'd spent time in prison. I mean, he was, you know, he's got that sort of romance about him that he'd walked on the dark side, and then come to a different way of seeing the world. Yeah, Kareem.
He constantly accused King of being an Uncle Tom, and his followers, and he constantly preached black militants.
Exactly. So he had the mantle of being the real militant, and Martin Luther King and his followers were Uncle Toms. The people who would give away the store. The folks who would give away the store. I want you to hold that when we get to the letter, right? Because King says something very specific about Malcolm X without ever naming him by name in the letter, right? But I think, I mean, when I first read the letter, when I first began to learn about the civil rights movement, it totally messed with my point of view, too. I thought Malcolm X was the tough guy and King was the softy. King was the easygoing guy, right? That Christian love thing, which never seemed to me to be a very tough thing. But here, go ahead. Turn the other cheek, right? And let someone smack you, right? That doesn't feel so good. It doesn't feel so good at all. But I think, as you'll see in the letter, it has a lot to do with a kind of discipline, which is really extraordinary. And it's something that King's followers took to heart. So, Project C, which gets us to Birmingham, is known as Project C for confrontation. How would you say it went in the first couple of weeks? You're shaking your head. Yeah, Shay.
Well, in the first couple of weeks, it backfired because the chief there used what happened in Albany from the police chief Pritchett. He decided to do the same thing, so he didn't. He just put them in jail, just as he done, and he didn't use any violence or anything like that.
He didn't use any overt violence at all. And you know what's most amazing? I mean, you're saying now, some of the people in our audience who tend to be my age, they know the name of that police chief. They know it really, really well, and they know it as the name of one of the most violent police chiefs towards black people in the 20th century, and here you're describing the beginning of this campaign, and he's not doing anything violent. What's the name of this guy?
Bull Connor.
That's right. He loved that nickname. Of course, if you have the first name Theophilus, sometimes you want a nickname, right? I mean, understandable. It's a hard handle to go around with. But this is a guy who had been, you know, police chief, was running for mayor, was involved in the governance of the town, had a long history of beating up black folk. And so when this campaign, this national campaign, comes to Birmingham, he studied what the guy in Albany did, and he knows that not only did he not provoke any violence in Albany, but Martin Luther King went home with his tail between his legs. So the movement was a flop. And so Bull Connor at first thinks, okay, if I don't do that, then the movement is not going to be successful, because what do they need? They need media. They need confrontation. They need folks buying newspapers. They need pictures. They need the cops acting badly. And he's not going to give it to them. So, we know that it wasn't going well. We know that it wasn't going well. Yes, Kareem.
Weren't they also running out of money?
Yes. The movement was running out of money because there were so many people in jail, they didn't have enough money to bail them out. This was really serious. And so things got really grim for the movement. Here, Fred Shuttlesworth, who'd been on the ground, did all this planning, right? He'd checked out the distance between, you know, to every store, every lunch counter, to figure out how long it would take people to walk there. He'd counted the lunch counters. He tried to do his own military kind of preparation for this, and Bull Connor had outsmarted him. They had several hundred people in jail in early May of 1963, and they didn't have the money to get them out, and it was getting harder and harder to find people to go to jail. Because Birmingham was a funny place. What was weird about Birmingham in its history? What did folks call it across the South?
Bombingham.
Bombingham. Why do they call it Bombingham, Heather?
Because it was known for like being bombed by the KKK.
It was known for bombing black people, so the KKK had a free hand at bombing black people. We also know, when we studied the Freedom Riders, that it was the KKK in Birmingham that the Birmingham police pulled back from and allowed the KKK 15 or 20 minutes to kick the tar out of these completely defenseless, nonviolent Freedom Riders. So Birmingham has had a violent civil rights history. It was very, very powerful. They expected they were going to get a confrontation, and they didn't. But given even so, in Birmingham, there was a black community, there was a more middle-class black community that was trying to exist without making waves. And they figured if they made a few amount of waves, some stuff would come their way. And it really did often. And so Martin Luther King spent a lot of time when he was in Birmingham trying to explain why he was engaging in these demonstrations to black folks who didn't want him there, because he was making their lives more difficult. He was making waves not only for white people, but in some ways he was making even more waves for black people and stirring them up. And it got hard to find enough people to go to jail. Can you imagine being in a place like Birmingham in 1963 and going to jail? Even if you're not beaten up, even if you're not disappeared, what could happen to you? What?
You lose your job.
You lose your job. Absolutely. And maybe not just you. Maybe your aunt or your uncle or your brother or your sister or your kids. To be willing to march for civil rights in Birmingham, Alabama in 1963 as an adult black person, I can't quite imagine the courage involved. I don't understand how people did it. And the kind of things that they were facing. So, we come to Good Friday, and this is one of the centers. History's messier. There's not always one clear center. There are a couple of centers, but one of the centers is Good Friday. Martin Luther King has announced his intention to have a march on Good Friday. Bull Connor, in advance of that, along with the city of Montgomery, has gotten a court injunction against over 100 named people, a federal injunction saying don't march, you can't march. And the number of things they said were illegal are unbelievable. There's a long list, including, you're laughing, Katie, do you remember what they are? You're waiting for me to say it because you've heard me say it, heard me refer to it before. You couldn't have a kneel in. You couldn't kneel down on the sidewalk. You couldn't have a pray in. You couldn't have a sit in. You couldn't do anything. So that injunction was a very serious piece of business. And Martin Luther King had to take it very seriously. So he and his lieutenants, including his father, who'd come over from Atlanta, gathered in a room at the Gaston Motel. the only motel that would rent to them. And by the way, the guy who owned that motel was the richest African-American in Montgomery, and he charged them market rates. A.G. Gaston was known, in fact, the biography of him is said, you know, Birmingham's black millionaire. So he's one of the guys. He's one of the guys for whom waves were being made. Can you imagine him charging market rates to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference in 1963? Charging market rates to Martin Luther King when he comes to fight segregation in your town? The guy was skeptical. Didn't even give him a discount. So about 20 of them gather, including Fred Shuttlesworth, who is a real firebrand, in the town. I mean, he's a guy who had been beaten so many times by the cops. It's just amazing what he went through in Birmingham long before Martin Luther King ever got involved in civil rights. So they're in that room, and they are arguing it out. If King goes on the march, he knows he'll be arrested. He's the chief fundraiser for the civil rights movement nationwide. The movement is broke. If he's in jail, who's going to raise the money? He's the only face that's known outside of Alabama and the Deep South among all the people that are there. He was constantly going to New York and other northern places to try to raise money for the movement. If he's in jail, it can't happen. Yeah, Lena?
At the same time, he knew that if he didn't go to jail, the media would leave because they needed something big, and him going to jail would be the best thing for them at the time.
His going to jail would be the best thing. Plus, if he didn't go to jail, it'd be like him not going on the Freedom Ride. It'd be like him not being part of the sit-in movement, not getting kicked and beaten the way those students had gotten kicked and beaten, not putting his life at risk by going on a bus again. It would look again like Martin Luther King had wussed out. What kind of leadership is that? He's publicly announced a march, and he decides not to do it because the courts give him an injunction? What does the movement look like then? It looks terrible. But the two sides, it was hard to know what to do. It was really hard. And he liked to listen to people fight it out and then make a decision, but this was particularly difficult. It's Good Friday. For a preacher, Good Friday is a big deal. The march was supposed to start at 1 o'clock. It's approaching noon on Good Friday, the time when Jesus was supposed to be on the cross. Preachers think about this stuff. There's sacrifice going on. The Easter weekend is the holiest weekend in the Christian calendar. And Martin Luther King, as he says in the letter, was not only a preacher. What else was he? The son and the grandson and the great-grandson of preachers. And he may not have started off believing as strongly. You know that he didn't. He was a party guy in school. But by the time he got here, he was thoroughly immersed in his faith. And it was Easter coming. So he goes into his room. He leaves them all fighting outside. He goes into his room for about 15 or 20 minutes. I've read about 5 different accounts of this, and people disagree about how long he was in there, what he said when he came out. Everybody says the same thing, though. When he came out, he was wearing jeans and a denim jacket. What kind of clothes are those?
Wears.
Pretty casual for what he usually wears. What did it mean that he was wearing those clothes? He was going to jail. Those were going to jail clothes. Those were not fundraising clothes. Those were going to jail clothes. And Andrew Young says in Eyes on the Prize at that moment, he said this. He said, I don't know what's right. I don't know what's going to happen. I have to make an act of faith. And I'm going to march. It's an astonishing thing, right? He didn't know. If he didn't know, who was going to know, right? He couldn't know what exactly was going to happen. I have to make an act of faith. And he went and he turned to Ralph Abernathy, his closest friend since Montgomery. And I love this story. He puts his hand on Abernathy's jacket and says, Ralph, I need you to come with me. And Abernathy says, Martin, you don't have to preach on Easter Sunday in 2 days. Because King had gone back to Atlanta to be on the staff of his father's church, precisely so he didn't have to preach every Sunday. Abernathy still had a congregation in Montgomery. He says, Martin, I got to preach on Sunday. And King, he loves people calling him Martin, right? I mean, people did call him Martin. Puts his hand on him and says, Ralph, I need you to come with me. And Abernathy goes, oh, I guess I'm going to jail on Easter. I better call my deacons. And so he knows he's not having to preach on Easter Sunday. And he and Martin Luther King walk out and they lead a demonstration. And what happens?
They get arrested.
They get arrested really fast. I think they manage to walk about two blocks and they're arrested. The cops pick up, they almost literally pick him up. I mean, they pick him up by the belt in the back, and it's almost like they lift him and almost toss him into the paddy wagon. And there, yes, Kareem.
One thing, like, when I was reading this, I was kind of shocked at the kind of religious parallels, like, between King and, like, what's in the Bible. With him kind of going to jail, like, you could say he's being crucified in a way, and then coming back and rejuvenating the entire movement, like, his ultimate resurrection. It's kind of, like, staggering once you look at it.
Kareem, it is why I find why I find this entire story so tremendously moving. It's exactly that. It's exactly that, because he was arrested, and they didn't just put him in jail. They put him in solitary confinement. They put him in the hole. The only light came from a little window, as he wrote later, at the top of the cell. He was alone in a tomb-like place for Easter weekend. Exactly what happened to Jesus, right? Taken down from the cross that afternoon, taken to a tomb, and was there 3 days, right? Martin Luther King didn't see anybody except sort of, you know, the trustee in the jail who sort of gave him food until, let's see, what did he see? Until Monday morning. 3 days, the same 3 days. His lawyer visited him. So here he spends Easter with no human contact, in the dark. And you know he's thinking about what you were thinking about, right? It is staggering. So cut him a little slack. He occasionally makes references and says he's sort of like Jesus. Here he was reliving, and for all he knew, redying, what had happened to Jesus. It's a powerful story. So on Monday, he gets the Sunday papers. And he sees that letter that we're going to look at in just a little minute and starts writing the letter from Birmingham jail. And that's all he's concerned about for the next week in jail, is writing that letter. And his executive director is wondering, what the hell's going on here? But he sort of realized, because King starts it in the margins of the newspapers and everything, he sees there's something big here. And every night he would have it typed up. He'd have his secretary type it all up and then bring him back and smuggle in fresh paper so King could keep writing. But King gets out of jail finally after 8 days, and where would you say the movement is? It's pretty bad. Did they get money? Yes. Actually, you're forgetting. They did. Where'd they get it from, Katie?
Harry Belafonte
gave them?
$50,000.
$50,000. And that was big money in those days. $50,000 in 1963, it's at least $250,000. It's a lot. It's what they needed. And there's a new biography out just about autobiography that Harry Belafonte wrote with another writer called My Song. And he talks a lot about the civil rights stuff. He got deeply involved in the civil rights movement. And he was a wealthy man. And he knew other wealthy people because of being in show business. But they had money, but what else did they have? They had nothing. The media was starting to leave town. Why did I say earlier it was May? It was April when all this was going on. The media was starting to leave town. And what happened? What happened, Sean?
They got together the March of the Children, 700 kids.
What was the idea behind the March of the Children? How did that come about? Yeah, Katie?
Well, adults had a lot to lose marching. They could lose their jobs and they had a lot more responsibilities than the children did. So they decided to get the children there. First, because if they got arrested, they wouldn't really have much to lose, but also it sparked...
Right, what would they miss if they got arrested, Katie?
School, and they'd probably
school,
be happy
right? Come on. How many kids are really upset at missing school, right?
I mean, but also it sparked a lot bigger reaction from people, and if the police decided to use violence, it would look a lot worse on TV for everyone.
And it turned out that the police, they held off for a little while, but eventually they packed the jails so much and they got under Bull Connor's skin and they pushed him. So what happened? They pushed and pushed, and what happened, Shay? He retaliated. And how did he retaliate?
With dogs and fire hoses.
With police dogs and fire hoses. Yeah, Kareem?
But again, with King issuing, like, the young kids, that kind of, that idea of, like, the radical and the militants, and even, like, Malcolm X was, like, disagreeing with that, along with the president.
Right, what did Malcolm X say?
He was like, the children are too young to even participate.
The children were too young, and a man doesn't make children do his work for him, right? Still. A real man doesn't have children go out there in front of him. Yeah, yeah, Katie?
I think it was Martin Luther King that said that if the children can like accept God and like decide their faith, then they're old enough to be able to stand up for something.
What's
like
interesting
this.
Is that King had to be talked into it. That was actually his lieutenant, James Bevel. Bevel was this sort of always slightly nutty, way out there, really brilliant tactician and theorist of nonviolence, and you saw him in Eyes on the Prize. He's the one who pushed Martin Luther King. Everybody had to push King. He thought deeply, but he also had to be pushed. He was appalled at the idea of children marching at first. He said to Bevel, you got to be kidding me. We can't do that. We can't do that. Bevel wore him down. Bevel wore him down, and the cameras were starting to leave. Now, is that manipulative on the part of the civil rights movement to do something that the cameras would like? What do you think about that? Are they just publicity hounds, Najee?
No, I feel like they weren't because they needed the media exposure to help fight the cause. They needed people to be interested and start like keep funding.
Why? Why do you think they needed that?
Because they needed people to realize what's actually happening in the South and, like, the impact of segregation.
They needed people where to realize that?
All over the country.
All over the country.
Especially in the North.
Especially in the North, where it was really easy to ignore. Yeah, Sarai.
People all over the world as well because of how the other countries were getting liberated.
Oh, you mean all those countries in Africa and Asia that were becoming independent during this time?
So if they were looking into the U.S. and seeing what was going on, embarrassment.
So they were willing to play to the world, to use world public the public opinion of people around the world, as well as in the United States, as additional pressure on the system in Birmingham. It's a gutsy thing to do, isn't it? It's a very gutsy. Yeah, Katie?
I think that's also why Kennedy was pretty reluctant and didn't want all these things to be happening because of how the other, like, everyone else in the world would view us.
Well, he didn't want these civil rights, activists doing what they were doing anyway. He tried to talk people out of doing the Freedom Rides because he was going to go meet with Khrushchev in Vienna for the very first time. So, excuse me, he didn't want that kind of stuff to happen at all. It makes the U.S. look bad. Hell, the front page of Pravda, which was the party organ of this, the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, covered the Birmingham struggle. And the Soviets were real competitors of the United States in Africa. They supported lots of independence movements that the United States did not always support so much. And so they made hay out of this. They loved being able to embarrass the United States. And that's one of the reasons why King got called a communist. Because what he was doing was in some ways supporting communist criticism of the United States. He was never a communist. He was never even close to being a communist. He was always critical of communists. But he was willing to embarrass his own government for not doing anything about civil rights. And John F. Kennedy had plenty to be embarrassed about. Although, as you pointed out, King was ambitious, right? Trying to get the government of the United States to act on these matters. They needed publicity. It's too easy not to look at how badly people are being treated far away. Or, frankly, seven blocks away in Hartford. There's tremendous poverty in this city. And right now we're in a gorgeous classroom, right? And everybody's got enough to eat, and everybody's got good clothing, and everybody's in this nice private university, and you have the luxury of studying. the history of the civil rights movement, and not very far away, people are tremendously poor in this city, which is one of the poorest cities in the United States. And it's easier not to look at it. It's hard to look at it all the time. It's even easier to not look at stuff that's 1,000 miles away, below the Mason-Dixon line, where people talk about down south, I don't want to go there, that's Dixie. So these folks in, these African Americans in the Deep South had a tremendous barrier to overcome, and they needed media desperately. Did it work? It worked. They finally got their confrontation. And it was on the front page of newspapers all over the world. And they got their negotiation. And they got agreements to hire African Americans in stores to serve African Americans in lunch counters. Seems like small potatoes, doesn't it? They had to go through all of that just to get a few people hired in stores. It's amazing, isn't it? That's what King refers to in the letter, which you've read now, about how it's sort of odd that the nations of Africa and Asia are moving toward independence with jet-like speed, while we go at a horse and buggy pace to get what? You remember? A cup of coffee at a lunch counter. That's right, Naz. A cup of coffee at a lunch counter. Exactly. So, ready to look at the letter? Good. Let's get the screen down, and then we'll look at both letters. This is great. Unlike the other classroom, this one has the screen attached to the on button, so you don't have to do two different... it'll take a minute or so to warm up. And let's see if I can get to what we want here. So, Sarai, since you have looked at this open letter before, what were you struck by?
I was just struck that it was clergymen that attacked King because everyone was opposing him at that time. It wasn't just people who were outside of the church or just a certain group of people. It seemed everyone was attacking his views and what he was doing in the movement.
What do you know about these 8 clergymen?
They were white.
They were all white?
And it seemed like they had a lot of credentials.
They did have a lot of credentials, and they were known as racial moderates. They were not the fire-breathing Ku Klux Klanners and White Citizens Council people at all. They were racial moderates. One of them is a, let's see, let's go to the bottom. And let's look at the list of people who signed the letter. These are not just ordinary pastors, right? These are religious leaders. Bishop of Alabama. Auxiliary bishop, the diocese. So the diocese means that they were what denomination? Either Catholic or Episcopalian there. Bishop of the Alabama-West Florida Conference of the Methodist Church. He's a high up in the Methodist Church. Another Methodist bishop. Here's a bishop of the Episcopal diocese. So this must be the Catholic bishop, and this must be the Catholic bishop as well. And here we've got the Presbyterians, lots of Southern white Presbyterians. And here we've got someone who's a pastor of the First Baptist Church of Birmingham, which I think we'll see a slide of in a little bit. And also, we've got a rabbi, right? Bet you didn't know there was a Jewish temple in Birmingham, Alabama. But there are enough Jews to have a temple, and the one rabbi in town, you can bet it was the only rabbi in town in Birmingham, Alabama, signs on to exactly the same letter. One of these fellows, because King even mentions it in the letter, I think it must be Bishop Carpenter, has already desegregated a Catholic college in town or very nearby. So these are the racial moderates. These are people that have actually, in some ways, taken brave stances with their own denominations and sometimes with their own people in favor of some movement on civil rights. And yet, let's look at their attitude. We don't have a long time to do this, but it's not a long letter. And this, by the way, was in the Sunday paper. So this may help us understand some of what's in the letter. We are confronted by a series of demonstrations directed and led in part by outsiders. So that's one of the reasons why King is so stung by this idea that he's an outsider when we get to his letter. We are convinced that these demonstrations are unwise and, what's the other word? Untimely. Absolutely, Nas. Unwise and untimely. Then they say that we think that there should be negotiation. Open and honest negotiation. As though somehow Martin Luther King is opposed to negotiation. So it's good context for the letter, right? You see what he's responding to. Oh, here we go. We also point out that if we incite to hatred and violence, however technically peaceful, they don't contribute to the resolution of local problems. And then at the end, they urge our own Negro community to withdraw support from these demonstrations. What do you think about that? Eight white clergymen asking all the black folk in town to withdraw from the demonstrations because they don't know what's best for them. What do you think about that, Tori?
Like, one thing I highlighted that he said in his letter, I don't know if it would be a friend, but he said that no one would be able to understand segregation and going through it unless they felt like the sting of segregation. So these people haven't gone through it, so who are they to tell these black people who are fighting for their own natural liberties that they should stop?
That's really very well put. Where is that, where's that line about unduly? It's a great line, actually, in the second... Where is that line? Those that have not felt unduly the sting of segregation. Do you have it?
It's on the third page.
It's on the third page? Oh, here we go. Perhaps it is easy, bottom of the second, first of the top, right? Perhaps it is easy for those who have never felt the stinging darts of segregation to say, wait. Right. None of these gentleman has felt the stinging dart of segregation. And neither have I. And neither had my predecessor at the University of Hartford in 1963, the person teaching U.S. history, who surely was white, surely was male, had never felt those darts either. And therefore, it was just as easy to ignore what life was like in the segregated South as to do anything about it. That's why they needed the media. That's why they needed Project C for confrontation. Anything else in this letter, Sarai, that you had read before?
I just pointed out, like you did, the timing issue. Everyone seemed to have a problem with the timing.
Everyone had a problem with the timing, right? We're supposed to take our time, right? We're supposed to take our time. I want to show you one last thing here before we get that. What's in the paragraph right above the one that I've highlighted? What's going on here? Yeah, Katie?
They're commending the law enforcement on how calm they have been through this entire thing.
Right. How calm the law enforcement have been as they have enforced the laws of segregation. Yes?
Like, the thing that strikes me is, like, it says, and continue to protect our city from violence. But these were non-violent, like, protests and movements. So,
protecting the city from violence is really from the violence of the law enforcement, because they're the only people who were violent.
They're the only people who were violent. Exactly. And I think we may want to go one step further, which King does in the letter, which we're just about to get to, which is that there is a violence in the laws of segregation that does not involve billy clubs and fists and people getting kicked, but there's a violence in the daily humiliations and injustice of segregation that, as long as the cops are being calm, everything's cool, right? No. Everything is not cool. Because at a certain point, something busts out and someone explodes a bomb. Or someone gets lynched. Or Emmett Till is murdered. Because these are the sorts of things that happen. So, let's go to the letter itself. And it's long, so we're not going to deal with the whole thing, obviously. So what strikes you, first off, about this letter? Sarai?
King seems to be very polite, because I know if that was me responding to people attacking my views and what I was doing, I would have been enraged. So I wouldn't have been as polite as he was.
It's hard to be that polite, right? Do you think he's really polite? What do you think? Maris, you're in some ways emotionally least, I think you feel least like Martin Luther King speaks for you, right? In certain ways?
I wouldn't say that, no.
You wouldn't say that? Well, tell me, what do you think he's polite in here?
I do think he's polite. He's very calm. He's very organized in how he organized, like, states his points.
He is calm. He's super organized. Does everybody think he's polite? I'm just wondering. Heather?
To be understanding.
So you think he's going sort of a step towards them to try to understand them?
Yeah.
Yes, Katie, and then Kareem?
I think there's like a little undertone of, like, I don't know if sarcasm is the right word, but I mean, like, I definitely don't think that his intentions are to be like understanding and like trying to like.
So where do you see that in the tone, Katie?
Well, when he talks about, like, waiting, and then he goes and gives, like, this long
sentence. Oh, the long sentence. Yeah.
We'll
get to that sentence. But you think, yeah, he's pretty worked up by the time he gets to that sentence,
exactly.
Right? Anybody else sort of feel anything in the tone that's a little less polite, Sarai?
Maybe.
Oh, I'm sorry. Kareem had it first. Yeah.
I disagree with Katie, like, what he's saying about sarcasm. And he has, like, a very politically correct voice.
What do you mean by correct?
Like, he's not just flat out saying, oh, these people, and accusing, like, just going off, like, what she said. He's, like, kind of, he has this underlying tone, kind of. Like, very calm and.
He's very calm.
And collected.
Yep. Very calm and collected. Sarai?
Maybe it's not that he's trying to understand the people who are opposing him. Maybe he's trying to be understood. So he's approaching them in a way that he would be accepted. Because, you know, if someone attacks you, in response to you attacking them, it's not going to really get far.
Well, you know, it's interesting. There's a person wrote a whole book about the letter and mostly about the response to the letter. And it's about the guys he wrote to. Almost all of them were devastated by the letter. They felt that they had gone a long way towards the civil rights movement, and instead, the movement turned around, and King in particular, and called him out and made them famous racists, and that all the risks they had taken on behalf of civil rights were for nothing after that. And for the rest of their lives, they remembered that they were the people. I was the guy that Martin Luther King nailed in Letter for Birmingham Jail. So they didn't think it was nice. Yeah.
I felt like, especially the part where he was talking about like the long sentence, there was like a lot of like impatience with it, because I feel like he obviously was trying to say that they've had patience for so long and they've tried to be nonviolent, and through all of their actions they had been very patient, and for them to say you need to wait longer was like ridiculous. So he just felt like the need to express himself that way.
I think you're onto something. I want to put out a possibility. I mean, I know that he was stung. I mean, that's what Sitkoff says in the biography. Because they were criticizing him. These were fellow clergy, right? And they were criticizing him on religious grounds. And for a preacher to be criticized on, you know, political grounds is one thing. But he lives on religious grounds. And so they went after him. You know, these are religious people, and he didn't like it. That's one. Two, I think he's furious. And I think the fury only comes out in that one long sentence. But I think he's controlling the anger throughout the rest of it. And so it feels to me, I have to say, the more I read it, feels to me like a spring that's kind of pushed together and coiled up really, really tight. Only he's letting the energy out, as Maris says, very controlled, very organized, very clear. You know, the words are all right, but I feel this kind of rage behind it. But he knows he can't be enraged because, you know, no one will pay attention to him. Yeah, Maris.
Well, I mean, I also don't think he had any other option. I mean, at the time he was very unpopular and people labeled him as an extremist. So for him to unleash this kind of rage would kind of play into their...
Completely play into their point. He can't do it. He absolutely can't do it. But I think he felt, I feel, and I could be wrong about this, and you are welcome to disagree with me, I have the feeling reading this that he felt sort of a little boxed into a corner, that he couldn't be who he really was. So he took the kind of feelings that he had about being in jail, in solitary confinement, and frankly, the movement wasn't doing that well. The Children's March hadn't happened when he's writing this letter, right? He's headed towards another defeat. And these guys are going to dance on his grave. And I think he's pretty upset about it. Because theirs, it looks like, from inside the jail cell, it looks like theirs is the interpretation that's going to win out, not his. Yeah.
And like another thing with the waiting, it wasn't just them. It was everyone. I mean, even his own dad was like, you know,
oh, that's right.
You need to wait. And so when you have so many people telling you this, it's going to come out. And I think a lot of the things that he directed towards them were also indirectly directed towards other people like his father. Like, you can't tell me to wait. I'm trying to make justice for you, for other generations. And like his own people were telling him to wait.
I'm so glad you remembered that and brought it up, because it's true. In the motel room, when he said that he was going to march, his father says to him, and he tried to get him to leave Montgomery, right? He tried to get him out of the Montgomery bus boycott. He was always saying, you go home, you come home, you don't have to be doing this kind of stuff. He'd made his own peace. And remember when King came to Atlanta, he sort of made a deal that he wasn't going to make any waves in Atlanta because it would make too many waves for his own man. His own father didn't want Martin Luther King making trouble in his hometown. And so in that hotel room, when King says he's going to march, his own father, Daddy King, says, I don't know where you get that nonviolent stuff. You must have got it from your mother. Yeah, I think he's talking to his father and to all the people that have said no. And he's way out there on a limb, right? He is so far out on a limb that he could be in the tomb, Kareem, right? It is pretty staggering. He's way out there and it's weighing heavily on his mind. Absolutely. So, you see how that outsider line is something that he really responds to, right? Why am I in Birmingham? And then he explains, he doesn't really allow the argument of outsiderness. And yet people do it over and over again. They always do it. They say, our Negroes are just fine. Our people are just fine. We don't need any outside agitators. That's a phrase that became famous during the 1960s in college campuses, too. People would say, our students are just fine. It's all these outsiders that come in and try to stir them up. Everybody always blames the waves that get made on folks that come from outside. They can't really think that people that they're living alongside would ever have these sorts of concerns. And yet they do. They have a hard time saying them. That's what the white folks in Montgomery learned. What else do you see in this letter that you want to talk about?
I have something. What about when King talks
about the two opposing forces in the Negro community.
Oh, that's great, Casey. Where are we in that? Where is that in the letter here?
We saw this in the video. We talked about it a little in the beginning. Remember, there's almost a slight divide going on in the community. It's more than just them not wanting King to interfere. Does anyone remember?
Where is that? What?
Who is he referring to?
Malcolm X and the Nation of Islam. Kind of like the extremes.
What about the upper, the wealthier black people? What about Gaston?
Okay, here's the paragraph, right?
Yes.
Whoops.
There's a lot of things going on. There's a lot of different issues. So what is he referring to? What is he talking about? These rifts that are coming along, because they're not all doing the same thing at the same time. You know, they all have different ideas, different opinions.
He's talking about how some of the upper class black people were okay with segregation to help their business as long as their business was getting along and they weren't upsetting the white people. They could still make money and go along with their own lives, and they didn't see the struggles of the lower class blacks who had to deal with segregation and weren't making as much money and were living in poor conditions.
So Martin Luther King is willing to be really upfront and to speak to his own community here, as well as to speak to the white clergy people. So he's between these two, and this comes in the context of being accused of being an extremist. So one that you just described very nicely, Lena, a force of complacency made up in part of Negroes who, as a result of long years of oppression, are so drained of self-respect and a sense of somebodyness that they have adjusted to segregation. And in part of a few middle-class Negroes who, because of a degree of academic and economic security, after all, there were black colleges, right? And because in some ways they profit by segregation. How do you profit by segregation? You know,
black people can only shop at your store, then of course you're going to make more money than if they had more options.
Action, exactly. They're African-American beauty salons, barber shops, grocery stores, restaurants, funeral parlors, churches. I mean, if churches are all integrated, you know, in Birmingham, then that means some of the black churches are going to have maybe fewer folks. Less likely to happen, really, in the South. King once said, I don't know whether, I forget whether he says it here, that, you know, the hour between 11 and 12 in the morning is the most segregated hour in America. And he was right. But yeah, there's a whole black community that relies on black economic contributions, basically, for them to live. Same thing happened with black baseball, by the way. The Negro Leagues, which had supported hundreds of ball players and businesses when Jackie Robinson came into the major leagues, into the white majors, African Americans went to go see white baseball. And within a matter of half a dozen years, the Negro Leagues were basically finished. Because most African American fans wanted to see their ball players playing in the white majors. And there are all kinds of ironies attached to that, because there were relatively few black players in the white majors for many years. Teams sort of had a quota, you know, maybe two. They didn't have one at a time. They generally have two. You know, if you really were getting with the program, you might have three or four, but not more than that. Then you'd be known as a black team. But African Americans, I mean, anybody, you guys know a little bit of the Jackie Robinson story, but you know, he came up with the Brooklyn Dodgers. The Brooklyn Dodgers automatically became African Americans' favorite team in America. It didn't matter where they lived, who they rooted for, what league they rooted for, they automatically rooted for the Brooklyn Dodgers. Same thing was happening here. With integration, maybe these folks would not be doing so well. And here's the other force, right? Bitterness and hatred becomes dangerously close, perilously close to advocating violence. Expressed in the various black nationalist groups springing up across the nation, the largest and best known being Elijah Muhammad's Muslim movement, which included Malcolm X, who was basically the most well-known minister of the Nation of Islam.
What about the other side to this? The idea that many of the wealthier black citizens consider the members of the movement to be just making trouble. Do you remember that?
Good question, Casey. What do you all think about that?
What did they mean? Their own people, they're the same rights they would both need, but these wealthier people with the same, you would think the same problems, but they're calling the members of the movement, they're saying you're just making trouble. What does that really mean? What is just making trouble? What is it really?
Devon?
I think that the people in the community, the more wealthy people in Albany felt that, Birmingham felt that, since they weren't accomplishing the goal, that SALC wasn't actually achieving anything at this point, they were still in progress, that they were just making trouble. If you don't see anything being accomplished, then all you see is the bad. And at that point, it just seemed like Martin Luther King was only living up to his expectations of coming in and ruining the cities.
Oh, what a great idea, Devon. I love this. So they hadn't succeeded yet, right? So if you don't succeed and you come and you have demonstrations, you're a troublemaker, right? But if you succeed later on and then you write history books about it, then what are you?
Legendary.
A what?
Legendary.
You're legendary. You're a prophet. You're a Nobel Peace Prize winner. You're a martyr. You get a memorial in Washington, D.C. But of course, when you're living through it, how are you supposed to know? So what do you think? If he'd failed, what, is he just a troublemaker? I mean, this is the point that you raise, right? Suppose they'd failed in Birmingham. Is Martin Luther King just a troublemaker? What do you think? No? Why not? Why not? Sorry. This is like what you fought about once before, right? What's the deal here?
Okay. So I'll just reiterate, success is composed of failures as well as achievements.
Say that again.
Success is composed of failures as well as achievements. So even if, just going throughout the Albany and everything, and there were a lot of failures, and then the Birmingham, but they wouldn't have been able to succeed in Birmingham without failing in Albany. They found out what not to do, how many demands they needed to make, how organized they needed to be by failing.
All right. So failure here is a piece of what constitutes success eventually. And by the way, that's something that students get to learn too. I mean, it's something that anyone who learns how to do anything. I mean, you have some musicians here. We have some athletes here. You learn by making mistakes and then learning how not to make those mistakes the next time. There is no way to learn to speak a foreign language without sounding foolish much of the time. I know, I've been through that. And I sounded extremely foolish. And everyone who's learned a language has all these stories to tell about having made complete fools out of themselves. But we do it anyway, and that's, you can't learn it without being willing to make those mistakes. Yes, Sarai.
But at this point, the middle-class black people who are opposing the movement and the nonviolent tactics that caused the uproar, they didn't see the success. All they saw was the failure. So they're not going to say, oh, well, the ultimate outcome is success. They're not going to see that.
It's
they're
going to really
see the
harsh.
Trouble of it. So.
They're going to see the trouble that they got to live with, right?
Yeah, they're going to label the people who are part of the movement as troublemakers because they don't see the success in Birmingham. They just see the failure of Albany and then what seems like another just uproar for no reason.
Katie?
The only people that are calling it a failure are the people that aren't necessarily going through as much of a struggle as the people who are trying to like make the movement. I mean, like the white people, I mean, they're obviously not really negatively affected by segregation. So it's really easy for them to say that you guys are just causing trouble and it's not a big deal. And then the black middle class who are not in favor of segregation, but economically it works out for them, like we just said.
I mean,
it's easy for them to say it's a failure too. So it just all depends on like what perspective you're taking.
Maris?
I mean, I would disagree with Katie because if you're an African American at that time, you would feel the aftermath of a failure of a certain movement a lot more than a white person would. So you have a lot more consequences to put up with even if they did fail. And
especially if they failed. You've got tons of consequences. You're left holding the bag. Martin Luther King is going to leave town.
Yeah.
He doesn't live in Birmingham. He's going home to Atlanta.
And I believe your question was, would he be considered just a troublemaker if he had failed at Birmingham? And yeah, he would. Because if he had failed at Birmingham, he would have been irrelevant. Because he just can't lead a movement anymore. I mean, yeah, Montgomery was a success, but after that, he would have just flopped. And so if he hadn't pulled the trigger on the Children's March, he would have been done.
Tori?
Today in my philosophy class, we were talking about a civil society and how, to have a just society, people have to give up, their executive, laws and their own personal gains for others.
Right.
So that equality can happen.
Right.
So even though the upper middle class blacks aren't necessarily feeling the sting of segregation as much as other people who had to go through it, that it's still there. Even if you don't see it, it's still there. And so they had to go through trouble with them so that equality could happen.
Right. But what happens if Martin Luther King fails in Birmingham? I mean, the course of history might really have changed because it was the success in Birmingham that pushed John F. Kennedy to introduce the Civil Rights Bill that became the Civil Rights Act of 1964. It was the success in Birmingham that led to the Great March on Washington in August of 1963 also. Would that have happened if Birmingham had been a failure? Uh-uh. Now, we don't know that King would have been a flop forever. We don't know that the movement would have been a flop forever. Something else would have happened. There would have been another city, and maybe it wouldn't have been Martin Luther King's leadership anymore. He might have been done for, Maris. I think you could be right about that. There might have been a rival at that point. We can't know these things because it didn't happen that way. I think we know that there would have been something because there was kind of a spark going on among black people in the United States in the early 1960s. Might not have been led by King, though, and that would have changed the course of history. Katie, did you want to disagree back with Maris? Or?
Okay.
No. I think you guys have, you folks have got the positions there. The civil rights movement might not have flopped, but Martin Luther King could have. You see, history, we don't know how it's going to turn out. You know, last night at, or not this morning, at 1 o'clock, the New York Police Department began clearing protesters out of Zuccotti Park in New York City. Later that morning, a judge issued an injunction against the mayor having done that. Before we started this class, people had gone back to Zuccotti Park and they'd had a hearing with a judge, and the decision was supposed to come at 3 o'clock, a little while ago. I don't know if it's come yet. So something is happening in the Occupy movement, and we're in the middle of it. And because we're in the middle of it, we have no earthly idea how it's going to turn out. What we know is it's not going to turn out the way people think it is, because history plays tricks on us, and we can never predict exactly. But we're midstream. Are they just troublemakers? If they flop, they may just end up being troublemakers. If they're the beginnings of a mass movement, then they turn out to be prophets, or what did you say? Legendary. And a young man that I met on Sunday who, the first person I actually know who has been sleeping out there, who we exchanged cell phone numbers, and, he and his wife got arrested last night. And maybe they're going to end up being heroes of the movement. I have no idea. Seemed like perfectly nice people. But they might just be flops and troublemakers. There's another paragraph that I want to get to in here before we've gone a little long. We're going to go a little longer. But I want to get to the point that, to me, is one of the real keys to this letter. I know that we have the wait paragraph, and then I want to do the paragraph about tension, because this is just too important. This is the wait paragraph right here, but I think we'll go just a little bit. Here we go. And this has to do with the whole question that Kareem raised and a bunch of you spoke to, having to do with the difference between Malcolm X and Martin Luther King. King talks here about direct action, not passive resistance. Direct action. This is something that the civil rights movement brought to place after place. And King sort of refined his ideas as things went on. He had a chance to think it through in Birmingham. There's nothing passive about this. And I want to just highlight these couple of sentences here. They gave him a hard time for not negotiating. He says, well, of course we want to negotiate. Indeed, this is the very purpose of direct action. Nonviolent direct action seeks to create such a crisis and to foster such a tension that a community which has constantly refused to negotiate is forced to confront the issue. Forced to confront the issue. It seeks so to dramatize the issue that it can no longer be ignored. And then I confess that when I read this for the first time about a little over 20 years ago when I first began teaching this material, blew me away. I didn't know that King thought like this. My citing the creation of tension as part of the work of the nonviolent resistor may sound rather shocking, but I must confess that I am not afraid of the word tension. This is a theory of social change that I hope you get to talk about in your philosophy class. Because people have lots of ideas about what makes change, and most of us would rather think that change happens kind of easily. And that people kind of wake up, and they have new ideas, and they change. And they decide that it's time for women to have the vote. Or it's time for African Americans to get the vote. Or be able to buy houses in white neighborhoods. Or for gays and lesbians to marry. And then they change the laws. No. This is not the way social change happens in the United States or any other place. It happens because people are willing to do what King is talking about in this letter. Create tension. Force negotiation. Move people out of their comfort zone. Insist that they negotiate things that previously they ignored. And you know, when you create nonviolent tension, you don't know where it's going to end up. You know, think of those people, those freedom riders. How bloody they were that we saw them. They weren't planning on that. They didn't think that that's the way they were going to live. Some of them were damaged for life because of the beatings that they got. They were willing, however, to push the issue, to create the tension that forced other people to negotiate. And because of those hundreds and hundreds of freedom riders that came through those same bus stations in May and June and July of 1961, the Attorney General of the United States made sure that the Interstate Commerce Commission issued a rule barring segregation on interstate travel and enforced it, was willing to enforce it. So these troublemakers are willing to force tension in a principled, nonviolent way to push people to change. And this time it worked. Doesn't always work. But I think he's right that change only happens when you're willing, when some people are willing to do this. Which is why anyone involved in movements has more courage than you ever think about. Sometimes they don't know that they have it. And that's why it's so much easier for young people to be involved in this. People my age, we think about this stuff too much. I'm just like those middle-class black folk in Birmingham in some ways. I don't want my world rocked. If I have to be involved in a movement, I've got to figure out how to park my car and who's going to take care of my dog, which is really a limiting factor. When I had small children, I had to be thinking about them. I had to be thinking about keeping my job so that I could afford to put food on the table for my kids. Having a family can be this tremendously conservative influence on people. For an academic, needing to get tenure is a really conservative influence on people. Now I just got to worry about the dog and the car. And the fact that, you know, and the fact that people like me have a lot of privilege. And if you get involved in movements like that, you could lose some of it. The way they were willing to put it on the line all the time. Listen, before we get to the photographs, the images of Birmingham, are there any questions that you all have that have not been met by this discussion and the letter? I know that we've got a little long, and I know the room is warm. Yes, Kareem.
Were there any government surveillance on King's family during this time, or was that afterwards?
There was plenty of government surveillance on King. I don't think there was surveillance on Coretta. At least if there was, I don't know about it. But yes, his hotel rooms were being tapped. I don't know about his jail cell, but he wasn't doing that much talking. And I don't know if the offices of the SCLC in town were tapped, were bugged. It's a good question. I would be very surprised. That's a great thing. It'd be worth knowing if the Gaston Motel was tapped, was bugged. Because I'd love to see those conversations. Somehow I think if they were, that some of the historians that have written about this, like Sitkoff, would have gotten to those transcripts. So I wish they were, because as a historian, I mean, that's gold. I'd love to see it. Anybody else? All right, so let me see if I can make the next electronic thing work. So, about a year and a half ago, about a year and a half ago, my wife and I decided she had a meeting in Atlanta right at the beginning of our spring break. And so I said, we couldn't do anything. We couldn't go far away. So I said, why don't we do a little civil rights tour? I'd never been to Birmingham. I'd never been to Montgomery. These are not places that I think of as vacation destinations. And frankly, after going there, I still don't think of them as vacation destinations. But she said, yeah, why not? What a cool idea. So this is the 16th Street Baptist Church, which was the headquarters of the movement in 1963, and obviously a newer sign, right? This is a statue of Fred Shuttlesworth, who was the head of the Alabama Christian Human Rights Movement and the guy who brought King to town, who nicknamed the movement Project C for confrontation, and he just died about a week or 10 days ago. He was in his 80s. He lived a long life. I want you to read this. The most amazing thing to me about Birmingham today is the way it has embraced its civil rights history. So all over the city, there are markers about the Children's March, the marches to City Hall, the marches to downtown to the stores, and they celebrate the civil rights history. So you remember the white lawyer in Eyes on the Prize who was talking about having been on the phone with A.G. Gaston at a certain point? Remember his name? Van. David Van. V-A-N-N. All right. So what you can't see, but if you look really closely, this is David Van, Birmingham mayor, 1975 to 1979. He later became mayor of the city. When that film was made, he was nowhere near being mayor, because the film was made in the late 80s. What do you think of that quote? Kind of cool, huh? This is a white Southern lawyer saying that these sidewalks right here in the middle of the civil rights movement are as sacred to the United States as Valley Forge, where the Revolutionary Army under George Washington nearly froze to death. A white Southern lawyer saying that those sidewalks are as sacred ground for the United States of America as Valley Forge. Martin Luther King transformed David Van. He was a pretty good guy to start, but Martin Luther King transformed him. I've never seen a city deal as well with a complicated history or any place. Here's a 16th Street Baptist Church. You see the sign up there, right? Top right. And this is in the middle of the demonstrations. This is during the Children's March. When the Children's March just started, because all the kids gathered in the church and then came down the stairs to the park across the street, Kelly Ingram Park. Here's the church again today. Oh, just so you guys see the white church. Is this a different part of town? This is the Southside Baptist Church. This is the white church. Big enough? It's like a city block, right? Here's another one. You can't quite see the whole thing, but you see that dome? This is the sanctuary, this thing with the enormous dome on it. So here's Kelly Ingram Park, which didn't have any signs back in 1963. It's been completely re-landscaped. So this is on one corner, right across from the church. And those words are pretty cool, right? Place of revolution and reconciliation. It's not enough just to be a place of revolution. There have been plenty of revolutions in the world, but when they end up chopping the heads off the losers, people remember it for hundreds of years. The beauty of nonviolent direct action, it was the only tactic that had a chance of converting the people on the other side. So here's the city of Birmingham, which eventually had a black mayor, Richard Arrington. Almost astonishing to think that this city could have had a black mayor. So I love these words, that there are revolution and reconciliation. You can't have one without the other and have it work. And that's sort of a circular thing in the middle of the park. Revolution, reconciliation. It's a statue of King. I don't know if you can read that. His dream liberated Birmingham from itself and began a new day of love, mutual respect, and cooperation. Unveiled in 1986. His dream liberated Birmingham from itself. An outsider, right? An outsider who brought nonviolent direct action, who said there is no real place of outsiderness in the United States, in the world, and he helped to liberate Birmingham. This is for all the rest of the people, the foot soldiers of the Birmingham Civil Rights Movement, and Richard Arrington Jr., it's the first African-American mayor of Birmingham. Here's what's at the top of the... later on, you'll see the rest of it. Here's the A.G. Gaston Motel. Look like a thriving business? It's closed. It's closed. I couldn't get over it. So I took a lot of pictures. The whole street's basically desolate. But, see, it's all locked up. But if you look in the courtyard, I think the room where Martin Luther King gathered with his people and where he prayed is in the corner up there on the second floor. Sad, isn't it? That's from the back. So this building, which is across the street from the motel, not far from the motel, rather, is called the A.G. Gaston Building. So he really was quite a successful businessman in town. These are all over town describing the marches. But here, look at this. The march route walking tour, you can walk the same march. You can walk in the footsteps of Martin Luther King on that day, Good Friday, in 1963. You are here, and you can go to the place where he was arrested. In the way that, anyone been to the Lincoln Memorial in the last few years in Washington? No one's been there? Oh, it's a very cool memorial. But if you go, did you know that the steps, that the place where Martin Luther King stood when he gave the I Have a Dream speech is marked by a star? You can stand on exactly the place. I wasn't supposed to take this picture. This is in the Birmingham Civil Rights Museum, where they said, no pictures. I couldn't resist. This is his cell. This is, I believe, if it's not a mock-up, I actually believe it's the real cell where King was for those 8 days and where he wrote Letter from a Birmingham Jail. So I took a secret photograph. This is the top of the Foot Soldiers Monument. I ain't afraid of your jail, it reads. A boy and a girl, and facing them, you see those bars? So if you go around, this is in Kelly Ingram Park, by the way. There are all these sculptures. Going back to 63, Birmingham Fire Department. And at one point during the demonstrations, when they set up the fire hose, they set them up on a stand like this. And you can sight it right through here. And there's a mock-up of it. So you can stand behind it and feel what it looked like to be on both sides. That's looking at that hose. Sculptures of children kneeling down in the face of the strength. You know this picture. This may be one of the most famous pictures of all to come out of Birmingham when they loosed the dogs and the dog got a piece of this young man's stomach. So the park has this sculpture that if you walk on the path, you have no choice but to go between these sculptures of these snarling dogs. It's a very heavy thing to do. I got closer and closer. Amazing, isn't it? This is what children faced on behalf of the civil rights movement. This, I don't know if it's actually Bull Connor's tank. Remember you saw the white tank that he used to sort of wander around in? I think this is it. But if it's not, it's a really good mock-up of it in the Civil Rights Museum. These are just some markers of the march routes. Oh, and there's Bull Connor's tank. Can a man love God and hate his brother? Trying to deal with white Christians. More of the markers. That's Birmingham City Hall, by the way. There was nobody there when I was there. Broad daylight around noon, not a soul. It was the weirdest experience. I never saw anybody on the streets in Birmingham. This was like March. It wasn't even that hot. One of the other civil rights churches in town. And now, all over Birmingham, they have these little markers. Not only was it a historic church, but it was part of the Alabama Christian Movement for Human Rights, and it was one of the churches where the movement had mass meetings. And then, of course, as you know, on September 15th, 1963, 2 weeks after the March on Washington in late August, basically, Klan-connected people bombed the church during as Sunday school was starting and killed four little girls by blowing up one corner of the church. Birmingham Fire Department, you see that again. You see bodies being taken out by African-American church members. There's no formal memorial. This is the corner of the church where it happened. But someone had left a wreath there the time we were there. People do that from time to time, and then they take pictures. They give tours of the building, but there's no actual marker. So this movement in Birmingham in 1963, at the absolute center of the civil rights movement, at the absolute center of Martin Luther King's career, and it produced the single most extraordinary and elaborated document about nonviolent direct action by the premier apostle of nonviolence in U.S. history. All of that happened in Birmingham in the space of a few months. Anyway, you all have been great today. Thank you so much. And thanks to the C-SPAN crew. And drink up your water and get some fresh air. And I will see you all on Thursday. And I will modify the assignment for Thursday because I know we didn't have anything past today. So I will watch Blackboard and you'll have more. So thank you all. Thank you, Casey, for giving us all those wonderful notes. And thank you for taking each other on. That was good. That was great.